I apologize for being here for not very long. The meeting happened to be bounded by family constraints on two ends. And I think if I were here for 2 weeks, I would probably have a better sense for how to structure the talk. Our work tends to be fairly mechanistic, and so a lot of the data that I will show will tend to be fairly mechanistic. But you should feel free to zone out for things that are of less interest, and tune in for things that are of more interest. So, intraocular circadian systems, some new tools, and some new insights driven by new tools.
Do I have the right talk here?
Yes. So, Neurospora, this is a rosette of acid spores, and here's Neurospora in the cosmic scheme of things. So the crown eukaryotes, and all these systems have circadian rhythms, as you know by now. These are the systems that people study in the fungi, chiefly Neurospora, and plants, chiefly Arabidopsis, and some work in Chlamydomonas, in insects, chiefly Drosophila, and in mammals, chiefly mice and humans. And we understand how human and mouse clocks work largely by analogy to Neurospora and Drosophila. And I have this branch here circled. Evolutionarily or phylogenetically, the last major division of organisms between animals and anything else was animals and fungi. And this is why fungi, including Neurospora, including yeast, tend to be good models for things that happen in animals. The things that happen within cells tend to happen in the same way. And one of those things, of course, is circadian biology. Neurospora is a great system for...
What about C. elegans?
Richard? Yes, but it's certainly an animal. I'm not sure. I'm not sure where worms come out on there.
After the insects,
not split off. So worms are closer to mammals than insects, I would guess. All right. I will plead complete ignorance on that. It's an animal. I'll buy that. And multicellular on top of it. It has neurons, but a kind of dodgy clock. I would maintain. So you've encountered Neurospora before here, but I wanted to briefly run through some reasons why people work on it. It's very tractable molecular genetics. The genome is about 43 megabases. It's fully sequenced. There are about 10,000 genes that are annotated, and there's ongoing annotation curation. Numerous regulatable promoters. We've targeted gene replacements now with very high efficiency, and I'll mention this technology briefly. We've knocked out, this is now about 2,800 genes, and they're increasing at about 200 a month. And these are, again, I'll touch on this, but the quality of the knockout library is quite good. And there are whole genome arrays available at cost, about $30 an array, which means that high throughput array experiments are feasible within a normal laboratory budget. As typical eukaryotic genome structure, multiple introns per genes, combinatorial gene regulation, typical splicing, normal centromeres, blah, blah, blah. 28 different cell types and real-world biology, including photobiology, multicellular development, cell and environment interaction, and of course, why we're here, circadian rhythms. All right, I put this together just in passing. A lot of our work and a lot of the work in the molecular basis of rhythms in Neurospora is focused on this single oscillator, the Creek white collar oscillator, which we've now been studying for some years. And you can see, so these are just the string diagrams that have been put together over the years. You can tell that the number of gene products increases, the size of the model increases, presumably something about our relative understanding about what is going on increases. But you know that's of course debatable. But we come back to here. So a lot of my talk will focus on this oscillator. It's important to have an animation. This one was developed by a postdoc in the lab, Arun Mehra. So briefly how it works is this. White collar one and white collar two transcription factors drive expression of freak RNA, which makes freak protein. It interacts with an RNA helicase, FRH. They move into the nucleus, turn off the activity of the white collar one, white collar two complex. Freak moves into the cytoplasm. It's phosphorylated by kinases, CK1, CK2. And about this time, white collar two disappears from the promoter. The phosphorylated freak interacts with its ubiquitin ligase, FWD, which ushers it to the proteasome, where freak is turned over. About this time, white collar 2 comes back on the promoter, and that cycle repeats about every 22 hours. So recently, work has made white collar 2 appear much more interesting than it had been, so I'll talk about some of that. The model in more detail, and I know that Peter has talked about Neurospora and Deb has talked about Neurospora. So to some extent this may be review and I'll go over it relatively more quickly, but I thought it was worth doing just to make sure that we're all on the same base. So white collar one and white collar two are two proteins that interact, make a heterodimer. They're a transcription factor that interact via pass domains. And this, the white collar one, white collar two heterodimer was in fact the first pass heterodimer identified in circadian systems. So white collar one, white collar two drive expression of the frequency gene. Freak then makes a trimer, it dimerizes with itself and interacts with this RNA helicase, FRH. And they act negatively on the production of their own transcript. There they are, trimerizing. And they physically interact with white collar one, white collar two, and turn off their activity. So that's a negative feedback loop. Freak also acts positively on the production of white collar 2 transcript and white collar 1. All right, so these are positive feedback loops. Freak promotes the phosphorylation of white collar 1 and white collar 2 in activating them. So that's the mechanism of this negative regulation. Freak becomes phosphorylated by a cocktail of kinases, casein kinase 1, casein kinase 2, CAM kinase, and PERD4, which is the neurospora checkpoint kinase 2. And that leads to their ubiquitination and turnover. So phosphorylation of freak here causes it to disappear. So you can start to see what's happening here in this feedback loop. These proteins drive expression of the RNA, which makes the protein. The protein immediately, or very soon, acts to turn off this activator. So it's now inactive. But while it's inactive, more and more of it is being made, but still being held inactive. And meanwhile, this time bomb has started with recessive freak phosphorylation, so it becomes more and more phosphorylated. Finally, it turns over precipitously. When it turns over, it releases this to restart the cycle.
Jay, in that previous little simulation
cartoon, yes.
Cartoon thing, you had it go into the nucleus and after a while it came back out.
Yes.
The process that's too
what causes it to do so?
Well, why does it go in at one point and then go out at another point?
Short answer is we don't know. There would be nuclear. We know there's a nuclear localization signal that's been identified. One would suppose there's also a nuclear export signal. That hasn't been rigorously shown. It might be that whatever goes in is turned over there, and what acts later in the cytoplasm to do these things simply never goes into the nucleus. That alternative hasn't been tested. And these interactions lead to oscillations in the level of freak RNA and creek protein. They're essential for the circadian rhythms in Neurospora, including nested loops affecting input. And the one exception to this may be the oscillator that Deb Bell Peterson talked about, the white collar flow, which may also be a true circadian rhythm in the sense that it may also have a circadian period length and be temperature compensated. And I'll touch on that. The changes in the level of freak RNA or freak protein are directly translated into changes in the circadian rhythms of the organism. So, for instance, light acts through white collar 1, which is the blue light photoreceptor. It induces freak, and that resets the clock, and that's how entrainment happens. So, induction of freak here would cause a phase delay. All right, so looking out now from the freak white collar oscillator, we know that drives some inputs or some outputs itself, and it receives input from a lot of areas through light, either through white collar 1, which is the principal blue light photoreceptor, or through Vivid, which acts on white collar 1. There are a host of other real and putative photoreceptors that may or may not, at least indirectly, affect the clock. That's why there's a dotted line here. And the clock also receives input through DNA damage, which acts through checkpoint kinase 2 to phosphorylate freak and reset the clock. The clock also regulates check 2, which in turn presumably regulates the cell cycle. So that's sort of, for people interested in cell cycles, an interesting ancillary loop. There are freakless oscillators which drive output. One of these we know is directly connected to the central clock is the nitrate reductase oscillator that Peter Ruoff has worked on. Those are regulated by temperature. More recently, Deb Bell Peterson has described a white collar freakless oscillator that requires these proteins but not freak, and it's also influenced by temperature. And it drives CCG16. And then within recent years, there's been a whole bundle of additional ancillary oscillators. Published, there are at least 9, and there are some now that are that appeared that are not published, and I think the list is continuing to grow. And for nearly all of these, so I'll touch on this later, their relationship to the circadian system is unclear. It's clear that they're there. Whether they're in any way connected with the circadian systems up for grabs. All right, so what am I going to talk about? I'm going to cover or attempt to cover three topics that are linked to the fact that the resolution was made possible by technical improvements in the system. First, I'm going to talk about a role for chromatin remodeling in the freak white collar circadian feedback loop. And I'm going to talk about a role for casein kinase 2 in temperature compensation, and then close with talking about a method we've, I think, perfected for simultaneous analysis of multiple oscillators in a single cell, and give an example of its use in establishing regulatory relationships between and among some of these separate oscillators within the circadian system. So in terms of mechanistic detail, there'll be a gradation from high to low. So for those of you that are not molecularly inclined, it will only get better as we go. All right, some brief introduction again. There are rhythms in freak RNA and freak protein. This is now data from the Pleistocene. Following here, freak RNA and freak protein. So protein phase lags the RNA, and they both cycle. This is the western, this is the northern. You can see that the RNA comes up, comes down fairly quickly. The protein comes up and goes down relatively slowly, and that there are multiple types of protein, and that the modifications in the protein change with time, that this is becoming phosphorylated to the point that it turns over abruptly, and then it's resynthesized the next cycle. The expression of freak is surprisingly complex. There are two promoters, an upstream promoter and a downstream promoter, that drive expression of RNAs. There are multiple 5' splice donor sites. the same acceptor site for the first intron. This region is in all transcripts, and then there's alternative splicing. The second intron can include or exclude the start codon for one form of the protein. So you actually get two different forms of the protein coming out of this. This splicing is temperature regulated. There are, in addition, upstream opener reading frames. These are all spliced out. This one and this one are not spliced out, and they can regulate the amount of protein being made. So you end up getting all of these different transcripts in varying amounts depending on the environmental conditions. So for a gene in a lower eukaryote, there's a lot of interesting regulation going on here. All right. Within the free promoter, there are two sites that are bound by this heterodimeric activator. This is work by a graduate student, former graduate student, Alan Froelich. These are electromobility. These are gel shifts. So here's the complex in nuclear extracts. It's competed away by self, which means it's real. It's not competed by non-self or by a mutant self. So there is a complex, and adding antisera to white collar 1 or white collar 2 shifts the complex up. So that means these are in the complex on DNA. Freak is not in the complex, and these are the pertinent null mutants. So white collar 1 and white collar 2 bind these two sites on the freak promoter. And of these two sites, Alan knocked them both out, and the distal site is necessary for rhythmicity. So here's a race tube, which you've now seen a number of times. If you remove the distal site, the strain is arrhythmic. It's behaviorally arrhythmic, that is, there's no banding rhythm. It's molecularly arrhythmic, and we did a 4-degree to 25-degree temperature step to prove that it wasn't just a loss of light perception on the part of the clock, but it's actually fundamentally arrhythmic without that distal binding site. So important regulatory elements bind there, and we've now called this the clock box or the C box. So Bill Belden, a postdoc then, asked what was going on at the C box, what is binding there as a function of time. So here's the distal light regulatory element, which is the same as the C-box, the proximal light regulatory element, the transcription start site, 5' UTR, coding region, 3' UTR. So he looked at a couple of different places to see by chromatin immunoprecipitation assay to see what was binding there. The first thing he found was that white collar 2 was binding rhythmically at the clock box. A nice cyclin binding. Surprisingly, white collar 1 is not rhythmic, or it's certainly not as rhythmic. This is relatively constant, whereas this is profoundly rhythmic. And the only rhythms were really at the clock box. There are no rhythmic changes at the proximal light regulatory element, the transcription start site, or the coding region. And additional data suggested that there might be chromatin remodeling happening at Freak. All right, so this is actually looking at the chromatin remodeling now. This is a cartoon of the promoter with circles representing nucleosomes, and that's the transcription start site. Remember, DNA is wrapped around nucleosomes, 146 bases wrapped around each nucleosome, and then there's a linker to the next nucleosome. All right, so the DNA wrapped up in a nucleosome tends to be kind of tightly wrapped up and not as accessible to enzymes like nucleases, whereas the DNA between nucleosomes is accessible. So here's the transcription start site, a nucleosome, the PLRE, nucleosome, blah, 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 the clock box, and another one. This is a partial digestion of micrococcal nuclease, which is going to cut between the nucleosomes. So what you can see, and this is dark and a light pulse. So looking in the light, you don't see cutting here, but you see cutting here. All right, so it must be closed there and opening. And looking down at the proximal light regulatory element here, you see cutting here and you don't see cutting here. So light causes chromatin to close up or be inaccessible at the clock box and to open up at the PLRE. Looking at the function of circadian time here in constant darkness, we're going to be looking again up here. It appears that the clock box is generally bound or closed during periods of clock-associated freak transcription. So in the late night to early morning, in this region, DNA is open, and in this region where freak is not being transcribed, it tends to be more closed up. So an enzyme must be doing this, that is, there must be a chromatin remodeling enzyme. But unfortunately, there are 19 switch SNF-like homologs in Neurospora. So, of course, you'd like to know which one is actually doing this. So 5 years ago, this would have been an impossible task to actually knock out in single strains 19 different enzymes. It would have taken us years. Now it only took a matter of weeks, and that's because we can knock out genes with great facility. We use a selectable marker, hygromycin phosphotransferase, to replace the open reading frames, and we have barcoding capability at either end so we can molecularly follow the knockouts. And the procedure overcomes a bunch of problems that used to happen. We make primers from the five. So this is the chromosome. We synthesize primers corresponding to the 5' and 3' end. So you can use these primers to PCR a 5' flank, these primers to PCR a 3' flank, and then mix the 5' flank with the selectable marker with the 3' flank, and these regions are designed to overlap with a gapped yeast vector. These four fragments into yeast, they overlap by about 29, by exactly 29 bases, but recombination yeast is so good that with virtually 100% fidelity, it zips these up. This is not a technique we developed. It's one we mercilessly parasitized, and it just works great. So for any of you that end up doing constructions with multiple pieces, this just beats the heck out of anything else. So you get this closed fragment. You can use the original flanking markers, outside markers, to PCR here. So just do a smash and grab. You get all the DNA, even the mistakes. But the only ones that form a functional product are the correct ones. And this is used to transform Neurospora. And when that goes into Neurospora, looking at 614 strains to just check the numbers, 98.6 have homologous integration events. 0.6% of these have ectopics. So 98% of the time, you get a clean gene replacement. And in the knockout project that I had mentioned, we're actually southern blotting each of these gene replacements so that strains that are deposited into the stock center now are biochemically verified as being ectopic-free, bona fide knockouts. So you can really hang your hat on these. This is one of the reasons why this is a nice system to work on. So 10 weeks later, Bill had the knockouts. These are the open reading frames. These are the homologies, and these are the phenotypes. This was knocked out in a band background, which may turn out to be important later. But only one of these actually had a circadian phenotype. It's the Saccharomyces function unknown 30, or human ETL homolog, the cartoon of the gene, the wild type race 2, and six different mutants. And you can see that this knockout has disrupted the clock. So Bill called this clock switch, by analogy to switch SNF. The banding is disrupted. The molecular rhythms are also disrupted here at the RNA and protein level. There's cycling there. There's about one cycle of cycling here, and then it settles down into more or less constitutive expression. So clock switch then is by homology, an ATP-dependent chromatin remodeling enzyme, and it's needed for proper rhythmic expression of Frege. When you knock out clock switch, rhythms are severely compromised. And in particular, this profoundly rhythmic binding of white collar 2 to the clock box has been lost. Lost or severely dampened. Also, binding of white collar 1 is reduced. So I believe the scale here is... Yes, scale is the same. So much more binding of white collar 1 to the clock box in the presence of clock switch than the absence of clock switch. All right, so that suggests a model where clock switch is needed to help eject white collar 2 from the clock box. All right, because here, white collar 2 is binding, and it's unbinding, it's binding, and then it's unbinding. Here, it binds, and then it just... The Dan Hicks song, it never goes away. So it's as if clock switch is needed to help white collar 2 leave the clock box, and thereby to...
This enzyme is undoing the histones or doing them up?
We don't know. We don't know. It's...
acetylase or...
It's neither. It's a helicase that is by homology. It's a helicase. It has a dead box. The yeast homolog has been. People are starting to look at it now, but there's nothing published on it. So it does remodel. This is work from Carl Wu's lab. That's unpublished, but not a whole lot is known about it yet. Deb?
So if you do the nucleosome assay, so in the clock switch mutant, do you see any differences?
Yes, and I think I'm there. All right, so consistent with this clock switch binding, the C-box is lowest late at night. So here, Frege transcription is increasing, and clock switch is binding. Here, Frege expression is decreasing, and clock switch is going off. So what Deb was implying, if that model is valid, there should be changes in nucleosome structure. So we actually looked at that. So here again is this cartoon, the transcription start site, the nucleosome positions, the proximal light regulatory element in the clock box. And this region out here is now blown up. And the question is, does nucleosome B here partly cover the clock box, and is it disappearing and reappearing as a function of time? So the way to do that is with monosome profiling, taking primers here where the arrows are. Primers here covering nucleosome B should detect a fragment that appears and disappears as a function of time. Nucleosome A should always be there, and as a control, if you really have a limit digestion of nucleosomes, there shouldn't be anything PCRing from here to here because all that DNA has been chewed up. All right, so here's the data. Nucleosome B, a weak rhythm, but a rhythm, high, down, up, down, up. Nucleosome A, more or less always there, and the control is gone. And this is just a control from a different region of DNA. The densitometry is here. So the relative amount of nucleosome B is changing with time. So it's being composed and decomposed. And in the absence of clock switch, there still may be some rhythmicity, but it's mostly gone. Okay, and so circadian remodeling of nucleosome B, or that nucleosome upstream from the clock box, is consistent with cyclical opening of the clock box assisted by clock switch. All right, so that gives us this kind of model now for events going on. Around subjective dawn, from late night to early morning, Frege transcription is high, white collar 1 and white collar 2 are bound, as the white collar complex clock box. White collar complex is becoming phosphorylated, causing its activity to decrease. But freak protein is increasing, it's being translated. By midday, freak protein levels are increasing to a maximum. White collar 2 binding is decreasing to a minimum. Chromatin is bound or in a closed state, and because transcription has been shut off, RNA is starting to decrease. Around dusk, freak RNA is low, white collar 2 binding is low, and freak is now becoming phosphorylated and destabilized. Around midnight, freak precipitously turns over and is low. New white collar 2 joins dephosphorylated white collar complex binding to the clock box. This is rapidly increasing. Clock switch binding is increasing, and there's initiation of chromatin remodeling, and that's going to lead to a renewed transcription of freak.
Did you see rhythmic changes in the level of the message? Did you show this for the remodeling?
No, the remodeling enzyme is there all the time, so other things have to be controlling when it accesses the DNA. Yeah, one would be concerned sort of about an infinite regress here, but it's not transcription. Okay, so that's the remodeling story. And we could get at this because we can knock out genes now.
What happens in light when you look at constant light?
We haven't looked at constant light at the nucleosome level. We have not. I don't know. All right, so another visit at the cartoon. White collar 2, which used to be just a partner for white collar 1, has now assumed some real importance. Together they drive freak RNA, which makes freak protein, which dimerizes, interacts with the RNA helicase, and they move to the nucleus, bring about phosphorylation, inactivation of the white collar complex. Freak becomes phosphorylated, and about this time, white collar 2 disappears from the promoter. Phosphorylation of freak makes it attractive to its ubiquitin ligase, FWD1. And for some reason, this is a very long lag. Ushers it to the proteasome, where freak is turned over. And about this time, white collar 2 comes back on to the promoter. Yeah?
So the freak protein actually appears twice in the cytoplasm, right? And it's first synthesized and after it's back to the white collar complex. The first time it's not possible that the second time it ate, so what happens between...
Freak protein is only made once. And that's the problem with animations. With animations, when you try to make them too simple. Freak is made in the cytoplasm. It interacts with FRH. In terms of what's going on, it goes into the nucleus and does things, but not all of it goes into the nucleus. Some of it still stays in the cytoplasm. All right. But at that time of day, which is mid to late morning, the stuff in the cytoplasm doesn't seem to be doing anything. It's sitting there, and it's waiting to do things. The active freak is in the nucleus, turning off white collar transcription. Later in the day, the freak in the cytoplasm is actually doing things. It's becoming phosphorylated, and it's also promoting the synthesis of white collar. It's promoting the formation of the white collar complex. And evidence suggests that it's different phosphorylation states of freak that are doing these different things.
So that means upstream kinase is kind of regulated differently during different time of day?
The different kinases are probably doing different things at different times of day.
So Jay, why do you do animation and not simulations?
the answer to that is fair enough, and it was down here. One of the points I will make in the last slide is that, of course, I do very little of this. Arun did an animation. A simulation would be great. And if somebody wants to help do one, I'd love to have a simulation. As implied, I think at the beginning, this is now becoming fairly complex, a lot of people are contributing to this, to the point that you're not quite sure what to talk about and what not to talk about at different times. So in terms of who does what, I talked about this because that's stuff out of our lab. FRH was identified in Ely Yu's lab. That's been published now for some time. Michael, we and E did the phosphorylation work on FREAK. Michael Bruner's lab has done all the work on the functions of phosphorylated FREAK in the cytoplasm, promoting white collar complex formation. Michael and E did the work on FREAK promoting the phosphorylation of the white collar complex. A number of different, and some of this is published and some of it's not published, and some of it, what is published needs modification.
My picture of, I mean, I was probably wrong, but my picture of the way that FREAK's regulating the light dark side comes up, not regulate, sorry, way dynamics is, that it comes up very, very quickly at the beginning of the light, and then slightly overshoots and goes down almost to a roughly constant level until the end of the day.
Yes. Yes, in a light dark cycle, that's
correct. If that were really true, if that creep bit were true, the only important things would be the beginning and the end. And so why do you have all this complex, incredibly complex transcription machinery if that's all that's important when it comes on and goes on?
Let's see. So it's not simply the protein, of course. It's the different phosphorylation forms of the protein.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about what the mRNA does, because you know that's driving the rest of the system. I'm just looking at the mRNA, and it looks very simple. It turns on mm-hmm. when the light comes on, and turns off when it goes off. Why is it complex?
You need a
lag.
In order for it to be a day of the
week. Oh, yeah, I'm not talking about all the feedbacks now. I realize that's very, very, very complex. But here we've got a very complex machinery just to control the transcription free.
Yeah, and in fact, what you're saying is sort of right. This pops up and then it goes away. What this first vignette had to do with was what's behind its popping up and going away. '94 when we realized that it popped up and went away, and we thought it would be something relatively simple. But in order for this to happen, there has to be chromatin remodeling. And in order, implied here but not stated, is there are two different forms of this protein. Right? In order for there to be two different forms of the protein, you have to have all this complex splicing of different isoforms that are regulated by temperature. So in the simplest case, To run a clock, you don't need both forms. You only need one form. Maybe you don't need all this phosphorylation. Yes?
So if I can make a shameless plug for my own work, I mean, I think the most universal prediction for all the clock models is that if you take a simple clock with feedback and delay, most of the time you won't get oscillations, and then only certain very specific transcription regulation mechanisms give you oscillations. And that goes all the way back to the work you know on the Goodman problem. What all this machinery is doing is it's making a very sensitive transcription regulation machine, such that you get these short transitions on and off, mm-hmm. which allow the molecules in the system to be synchronized and allow you to get rhythms. But that's just the shameless plug.
No, I think you're right. And then this, of course, is the value of modeling, is that it turns the simple molecular observations where you can say, oh, it comes up and down, and of course it makes it takes a while to make protein, it takes a while for protein to feed back, so of course negative feedback loop, you're going to get an oscillation, which describes all of the modeling done between late 80s and mid 90s among the people who weren't modelers. That is, the models were all of the kind that I showed in that second figure. Just string diagrams with no sophistication, and the kind of modeling that you're suggesting gets at the question of what do you really need to oscillate is distinct from feedback.
It's not just negative feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that. Okay. So anything else on mechanism? On compensation. Circadian effects of temperature. And this may be partly review also. So there are actually three different effects of temperature in circadian systems, including in Neurospora. Resetting and entrainment resulting from steps and pulses between temperatures within the physiological range. This is not talking about heat shock, but talking about relatively small steps, and steps can be as small as 1 or 2 degrees even. In Neurospora, this is modeled as a result of temperature-dependent increases in free protein. There are temperature limits that are permissive for rhythmicity within the physiological range, and this is true in Neurospora and in all organisms where it's been examined. In Neurospora, this is modeled as a result of temperature-dependent synthesis of the two different isoforms of Freak, a long form and a short form. And the third aspect of temperature is temperature compensation of period length, which perhaps is an aspect of general compensation or homeostasis of period. And that hasn't been studied very mechanistically, really, at all. Temperature compensation arises from, the concept arises from a paper by Hastings and Sweeney in 1957. This is looking at bioluminescence and goniolax. Here are the rhythms done at a bunch of different temperatures. This is plotting period length versus temperature. And what they saw was that it, first of all, it wasn't flat. So the rhythms are not temperature independent. There's some active process going on here. And the second thing is that it's not just like this or just like this, but there's active modulation. So they said the experiments reported here describe the effect of temperature upon a luminescent rhythm. The results suggest that temperature independence is achieved by a compensation mechanism. So that's why we talk about temperature compensation. Even clocks in vertebrate cells in culture, like fibroblasts or adipocytes or chick pinealocytes and whole tissues, show this temperature compensation mechanism. So even tissues from vertebrates, from mammals, where there is temperature homeostasis, when you take them out of the organism, those clocks still show temperature compensation.
This show doesn't show temperature compensation.
Well. Yes. Well, look at the axis. It's between 23 and 26 degrees.
It's close to usually 1.2 or 1.1.
I think with it depends where you look. Here, so here it's about 0.85. Here it's about 1.05, if memory serves. All right. So, depending on how liberally you want to construe compensation, people will take between 0.9 and 1.1, or between 0.8 and 1.2. Certainly, if the axis went from 5 hours to 40 hours, this would be a lot flatter.
So 3 hours.
Right. So. So temperature compensation then is a defining property of circadian rhythms. One can think about perfectly compensated, which would be like temperature dependent, like the color change in yucca that misled Frank Brown for so many years. Perfectly compensated, so it looked like it was temperature independent. But you can have slight undercompensation or slight overcompensation. So although it's a defining property, it's been one hard to get at through mutational analysis. So for instance, if the period length is dosage dependent and you had a temperature sensitive clock protein that became unstable at higher temperatures, a compensation experiment turns into a dosage experiment, and that could mislead you in terms of functional analysis. So that's like Perlong in flies. If you had an extra stable clock protein, you'd expect to have a long period length and also altered compensation. All right, and that's like Freak 7 in Neurospora. So individual point mutants could be misleading. A variety of models and approaches have been used to get at compensation. Schematically, this is the Hastings-Sweeney model. A to B describes a reaction that's involved in the clock. C to D describes a reaction that's not involved in the clock per se, but that makes a product that feeds back to affect the rate of the A to B reaction. So as the temperature goes up, they both go faster, and the A to B reaction ends up being compensated. There's a model based on sizes of limit cycles described by Lake and Thomas and Brody, where the limit cycle at low temperatures is smaller than the limit cycle at high temperatures. One assumes that as the temperature goes up, the angular velocity here increases, but because there's a longer transit time, the period length would be about the same. There are a number of models describing competing intramolecular and intermolecular actions, mostly in Drosophila having to do with PER. There's a model on opposing effects of dimerization leading to a stable steady state versus nuclear entry leading to a stable limit cycle, with which some of you may be familiar. I encourage everyone here to read this. And then there's the balance equation model. That the cycle will be the summation of many reactions, and in the aggregate, their control coefficients multiplied by their activation energies must sum to zero. And this is work that Peter Ruoff has been pursuing. This is at least reminiscent of work from Intermolar's lab showing feedback between loops in the Arabidopsis clock. This loop feeds back to affect the rate of this loop. And this is reminiscent, at least, of recent work from Zebrafish, where the amplitude of the PER4 oscillation changes a great deal as a function of temperature. But all of these models don't speak a lot to mechanism. There's the genes and proteins involved in compensation. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we tend to be mechanistic, and so that was what we were interested in trying to get at. So rather than looking at mutants that lose compensation, we thought we could look at mutants that had better than normal compensation. And in Neurospora, from Jerry Feldman's work, there are two. Wild type is here, pretty well compensated in the range from 18 to about 30 degrees, and then compensation falls off. There's a mutant called Chrono that's compensated well out past 30 here, and there's a mutation called PERD3 that's actually overcompensated. So these are strains in which compensation works better than normal. So we decided to see if we could get at a mechanism, or at least get mechanistic. This is work from a postdoc, Arun Mehra, and a graduate student, Mishi. So, they cloned Chrono and PERD3. Now, 6 years ago, this would have been a long process. I spent 6 years cloning Freak, and 2 years after we actually figured out what to do, still took 2 years. So this could have been potentially a long project. In the event, it didn't take them nearly that long because they were able to use SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, that were available because of the sequencing and annotation work from the Genome Project. So SNPs localized chrono to this region in particular. This one recombined with chrono at about 17%. This one recombined with chrono about 4.9%. And that gave a candidate gene up here of CK2 beta, the beta subunit of casein kinase 2. CK2 alpha was identified as a candidate locus for PRD3. Again, SNPs localized it within this region. There were cosmids available within that region. One of those cosmids rescued function, looking within the open reading frames of that cosmid, CK2 alpha. So we subsequently proved by knock-ins that taking this DNA would rescue the mutation. So these actually are chrono and PRD3. By sequence, chrono is a an arginine to cysteine mutation in the tail region of the beta subunit. So the tail region is involved in association of, should back up. Casein kinase 2 is a tetramer, two alphas, two betas. The betas interact with one another and bring the alphas with the catalytic subunit together. The catalytic subunits don't actually touch each other. So chrono is a mutation in the tail region that helps the tetramer to associate. PRD3 is in the phosphate anchor region of the catalytic subunit. The phosphate anchor region is close to and a part of the catalytic core. So the important thing here is that two independent mutations from separate screens showing enhanced compensation identified two distinct subunits of the same enzyme. So that's either a remarkable coincidence or it's informative. So of course, CK2 is well established as a clock-affecting kinase. The first work was from Elaine Tobin's lab in Arabidopsis, showing that the beta subunit associates by two hybrid with CCA1, and that casein kinase 2 actually phosphorylate CCA1 and shorten period lengths. Second time it turned up was work from E. Liu's lab. CK2 contributes to in vitro phosphorylation of FREAK, and mutation of CKB1 affects period length. And finally, in Drosophila, both Andante and Timekeeper, two different genes, define beta and alpha subunits respectively, and they're involved in phosphorylation freak and effects on period length. So having CK2 turn up in the context of clocks is not a real surprise. So we went on to try to analyze this. Deletions of the beta subunit are arrhythmic, and they're shown here. Deletions of the alpha subunit didn't pass through meiosis, so either they're required for meiosis or they're essential genes, but in any case, they're harder to study. So we focused on studying the beta subunit. So this means that we could look at the effect of gene dosage of beta on temperature compensation. So to do this, we used a regulatable promoter to drive the beta protein. So this is a gratuitous regulator in the best sense of the word. It can be eaten by Neurospora, but in appropriately engineered strains is not eaten by Neurospora. It's simply given and will induce gene expression. And it is slightly leaky, so even in the absence of inducer, there is a very low level of gene expression, which actually turns out to be useful. So in a beta knockout background, increasing the dosage of beta first restores the rhythm and then reduces the period length. So again, here's the knockout, arrhythmic. And these are two different transformants bearing this inducible copy of beta. So at no inducer, this is the leaky transcription, you do get a rhythm back, but it has a very long period length, 28 to 30 hours. As you start to add inducer, 10 to the minus 4 molar, the period length goes down, and as you add more inducer, it gets to a range where it's quasi-normal. So we can dial in period length then as a function of inducer. That means you can do the compensation experiment now, which is here. So the dosage of CK2 beta determines the temperature compensation mode. So at high dose, you get something that looks very much like wild type under compensation. As the dose goes down, one infers that you pass through a region of better than average compensation. And at low dosage, there's distinct overcompensation. And worth noting, these are experiments only changing the dose of a wild-type copy of the regulatory subunit. So there aren't any mutants here, not any mutants in the sense of proteins that don't work correctly. It's just how much of the protein there is.
Yeah.
This is about 1.1, and this is 0.8 or 0.75. We should talk about that later. I think I have those numbers. I don't have them. That's a question that came up before, and I should know the answer, and I apologize if I don't. Yeah. John?
Is the wild-type CK beta gene circadian regulated, or is it constitutively?
I'm almost positive it's constitutive. I'm 95% sure. Which for a lot of reasons would make sense, and that's why I'm almost sure. Is it these workhorse kinases are involved in so many different processes that it would arguing teleologically. If I were the creator, I wouldn't want to have CK2 beta being circadianly regulated because it would have so many knock-on effects. And I'm pretty sure we've looked at that also, and it's not. Yeah.
So when I was presenting some more data, I got a question, so I'd like to throw the question at you.
It must be a great question.
You're also a person said, well, when you do these gene dosing experiments, how do you know that the dosing is a temperature dependent, basically? And how do you know that doesn't confound your result?
The dosing may be temperature dependent. We've, in many cases, or most cases, actually measured the amount of product that we're getting. Like here, okay, where different amounts of inducer, you can actually measure the amount of protein that you're seeing. I'm not threatened. I want to make sure I'm explaining it.
And you've tried that at different temperatures.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
These are not. It's a sort of craftsmanship that one wants to do. One could give a whole other talk about craftsmanship in molecular biology. So we have all these power tools now, and people, the tendency, of course, is to use the power tools and knock things together very quickly rather than making dovetailed joints. But craftsmanship's a good thing to actually check things. Okay. Changing the dosage of a regulatory subunit of the wild-type protein. All right. So, skeptic will say that perhaps then everything that changes period length will affect compensation. I would assert that we already know that this is not true. Short period length mutants of freak, for instance, affect period length but don't affect compensation. long period length mutants or freak do affect compensation. But maybe it's kinases. So we set out to test that. The dose of casein kinase 1 affects period, but not compensation. So actually, CK1 is essential. It works as a monomer, not two different subunits, and CK1 has to be present in the cell. So in order to modulate gene dosage, Arun knocked in to the wild-type copy the QA2 promoter. That is, he replaced the wild-type promoter with the QA2 promoter. So now this strain, this homokaryotic strain, expression of CK1 is dependent on this promoter. All right. So at no QA added, this is the leaky expression from this promoter. The strains are alive, which is important, and they have a very long period length. As you start dialing up the amount of inducer, the period length goes down, and at a high level, you get the wild-type period length. And then the compensation experiment is here. Wild-type. Slightly lower level of expression, slightly lower level of expression, and slightly lower level of expression. So you can have large effects on period length, but not large effects on compensation. Compensation is about the same, even though the period length is longer. So not everything that affects period length, at least not every kinase that affects period length. We also did this with, low CK1 dose results in normal undercompensation. Normal for Neurospora, under compensation, does not result in anti-compensation like low doses of CK2 beta. We also did it with protein phosphatases, PP1 and PP2A. So deletion of serine threonine protein phosphatase PP1, shown over here. These are in heterokaryons, I'll point out. So when we do transformance in Neurospora, Neurospora grows as a syncytium, so it's more like a muscle cell than a fibroblast. When you do a transformation, just one of those nuclei will be transformed, and as the syncytium propagates, you'll have a mixture of wild-type and mutant, wild-type and transformed nuclei. All right. So this is a poor man's gene dosage experiment. And we're cleaning this up now to make homokaryons. But in the heterokaryon, you have clear period effects, but you don't have clear compensation effects. Likewise with PP2A, period effects, but no compensation phenotype when assessed as heterokaryon.
Those period effects aren't nearly as strong as for the kinase.
That's right. And in fact, with knockouts of this is work by E. Liu. Knockouts of PP. Jeff Hall would say PP Dickey. Knockouts of one of these two have a period effect of 1 hour, which is. Have period effects of 1 hour. So the period effects for phosphatases are nothing like the period effects for kinases. All right, so it's not the case that changes in dosage or activity of any modifying enzyme will affect compensation. So back to this again, CKB1 dose affects temperature compensation mode. In other words, it's looking like casein kinase 2 is somehow special. So we've begun to focus more closely on CK2 activity as a function of dose and temperature to try to get at this and understand it. CK2 directly phosphorylates freak. This is GST freak added to extracts. This is radioactive. Let's see. So casein kinase 2 will use ATP or GTP as a phosphate donor. CK1 and most kinases will only use ATP. So by using GTP, one can specifically assay CK2. So this experiment is using radioactive GTP in extracts, letting everything get phosphorylated and then pulling down freak with antibody to FRH, since FRH and freak form this tight bind. And you can see Freak is phosphorylated, and then the phosphatases start to act, and it becomes dephosphorylated. But clearly, Freak is phosphorylated in extracts. This is, again, using GTP, CK2-specific phosphorylation of Freak in whole cell extract by Western. This is Freak. This is phosphorylated Freak at 25 degrees and at 30 degrees. You can see more phosphorylation as the temperature goes up. And this is using an artificial peptide to actually do some biochemistry. So looking, wild type is squares, wild type at 25 degrees, wild type at 30 degrees. The mutants are triangles, mutant at 25 degrees, mutant at 30 degrees. Okay, so CK2 directly phosphorylates Freak, and even at low dosage, CK2 displays a normal temperature activity profile. That is, as the temperature goes up, the activity of the enzyme goes up. So one model would have been that there was something that at low dosage, as the temperature went up, CK2 just fell apart. So you had actually less enzyme there and it wasn't acting as much, but that's not the case. Even at low dosage, this is the strain with no QA. Even at low dosage, as the temperature goes up, you actually have more activity. But even though CK2 activity increases at higher temperatures, at low dose, Freak degradation decreases as a function of temperature. So this is the stability plots. This is wild type, normal dose, about the same at 20-25. This is at low dose. Clearly, as the temperature is going up, Freak is becoming more stable, surprisingly. And this is the looking at the half-lives. So since the kinetics of Freak turnover are a major determinant of period length, and this is something that I think everyone agrees on, data are consistent with the observation of increasing period as a function of temperature at low dosages of CK2. That is, that's what we've been showing. And importantly, they recapitulate the chronophenotype. This is the chronophenotype. Chronomutation in CK2 inefficiently phosphorylates Freak and thereby slows degradation and increases period. All right, so looking here at 4 hours, wild type and mutant, looking at phosphorylation of Freak at two different temperatures, 25 and 34 degrees. By 8 hours, mutant is less phosphorylated than wild type. And as 34 degrees, it's much less phosphorylated. Looking out here further, 16 hours, wild type and mutant. Wild type has already become maximally phosphorylated, mostly turned over. You can especially see that out here at 34 degrees. And this is already turned over, and this is still becoming phosphorylated. So this implies the existence of more than one class of CK2 phosphorylation site on Freak, one of which might specifically affect turnover at higher temperatures. This is one way to think about these data, and perhaps not the only way, and perhaps not the correct way. But if this is the case, then one ought to be able to find such a mutation in Freak. So we searched among existing mutations and re-engineered some mutations in sites that looked like they ought to be CK2 phosphorylation sites. So these are, so here's wild type, 25, 30 degrees. Where you can just barely, can you see the 25 degrees?
No.
So here, 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 and here. Wild type, and then three different mutants that have been published from Eli Yu's lab, showing the, in all cases, period length going down to the slight undercompensation that's typical for Neurospora. And then this mutant that Arun engineered in a CK2 site near the C-terminal end of Freak, that where period length does not go down. So this one predicted that there ought to be such a mutation, and that looks like it is one. All right, so working model then is that we know that FREAK has a number of different phosphorylation sites, and phosphorylation of different sites can lead to or promote distinct consequences. Degradation from Eliu's work and our work, white collar formation from Michael Bruner's work, perhaps degradation in a temperature-dependent manner. So CK1, for instance, is involved in turnover and also involved in promoting white collar formation. CK2 is involved in turnover, and perhaps specific sites are involved in turnover at higher temperatures, either because they become exposed at higher temperatures or become they're always exposed, but they have more effect at higher temperatures. Okay, that's it for compensation. I think the last part will be quicker. Yes, Hero.
From under to over.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm sure you have it yet.
So it means that as a parameter, you somehow inhibit.
No, CK2 should promote compensation. So as the temperature goes up, the period length goes down. And at high CK2, that's the case. As temperature goes up, period goes down. So to the extent that in an uncompensated system, as temperature goes up, the clock should run faster, and period should go down.
But the compensation, yeah. The term that matters is the control coefficient of this phosphorylation rate times the dependence of that phosphorylation rate on temperature. And you showed that both of those are non-zero, right?
Yes.
So you have to take the combined things of the temperature compensation, but for the period change, then you have to take the control coefficient. So that's why you can have things that cause a period change but don't change the compensation. I think it all hangs together.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm also slightly confused. Well, I think about it in a somewhat simplistic way based on these things in Sweden. Yeah, that certain processes, temperature increases, work faster, which should cause the period to shorten at higher temperature. And that seems to me to be what the Casey Chinese students do. And so based on the Hastings and Sweeney theory, which may or may not be correct, I mean, that's been for quite a while, it seems that, while this is working, and you're beautifully showing if you go from compensated to overcompensated to undercompensated, which is a validation of that theory and a validation of Peter's term, it seems like there should be some other player somewhere on the clock that, as temperature increases, is making the theory more developed.
I disagree. I think it's difficult to say because you've got so many factors, but I think it hangs together and you can take Peter's equation and just look at the changes in the term.
Well, Peter's equation needs both pluses and minuses to be.
But you're just changing one term here.
I completely agree. It validates Peter's theory. But I think in order for Peter's theory to be right, they need to be. So maybe Peter should speak about this. But you need some coefficients with positive and some with negative. And
yeah, I'm not quite sure what I should say here. But it
does say.
Peter, are you sure? You want to?
you know, the control coefficients, they need to sum up to minus one. So you need, and I like to see it in this way, in order to get the compensation, you need some positive terms, and it appears to me the kinase is.
No, but the point here, Peter, is that you're starting off with a temperature compensated system,
yeah,
and then you're just changing one term, the term that's associated with this phosphorylation rate, or maybe it's several phosphorylation rates because it's maybe done multiple.
Yes.
But you're just changing that term so you can see whether they increase, you can see if the control coefficient increases or not, and, if it's positive or negative, and it's positive here. And then you show data on the temperature dependence and phosphorylation process. And so the derivative of the phosphorylation rate with respect to temperature also has a definite sign. So you can check to see whether the signs are right to predict either overcompensation or undercompensation.
The problem here I see is that the theory is sort of spelled out in terms of elementary processes. But what we have here is already lumped processes. We have already quite complex processes. So we have a lumped control coefficient for, let's see, the phosphorylation, the degradation. But let's see, in the exact theory, you would need to still know these elementary processes in order to see which actually have positive and negative contributions. And I think we still do not know this. But perhaps you can lump it.
It would be fine in terms of lumped.
Excuse me?
It would be just as good in terms of lumped coefficients, yeah, as long as you know them. But the bottom line is that these control coefficients can be both positive and negative. Right? And the fact that there is some rule saying that the sum is minus one doesn't constrain individual terms.
So, yeah, if I could just interject, I mean, from a mathematical perspective, sure, we could say they all have this sum to minus one, that's good, that's great. I'm more interested in the biological mechanism. And I'm interested, personally, so this is my own bias, but I'm interested in what biological mechanism would you have a rate that would be more active at higher temperatures that would cause the period to lengthen? And I think this is still an outstanding issue, it seems to me.
What biological process would cause it to shorten?
As temperatures, you would expect, as reaction rates, temperature increases, reaction rates increase, mm-hmm, the period should shorten.
Yes.
I'm interested in identifying a process that, as I think was Hastings and Sweeney's original idea, a process that as temperature increases, it runs, the process becomes quicker, and then the period lengthens.
That's just the control. I don't see why that's so surprising, I guess. But some processes run faster and the period gets longer. That's just the control coefficient.
I agree mathematically. I'm interested in biologically what's causing that. And they haven't identified it yet. Mm-hmm. I'm just pointing that out. You may not find it interesting.
No, I would agree. We have not identified it yet. Yep.
So speaking to also phosphorylates like collagen,
yes,
and like collagen.
Probably.
Yeah. So have you looked at that, those events,
no,
at different temperatures?
No.
That might play into this.
Yeah. Yeah. It might, in fact, and we haven't. Yeah. Richard?
Now, the CHR mutant, it looked like the period was closer to 24 hours than,
yes,
wildlife, and the temperature compensation is better.
Yes.
So why hasn't the system evolved to that?
That's an excellent question.
24 hours might give you the wrong phase. It may be perfect for training, but you'd be the wrong phase of the product.
That would be the Pittendrigian argument that in order to get good resetting, you want to have a period length away from 24, and depending on whether the most important events are day active or happening in the day or the night, you want to be slightly longer, slightly shorter than 24. So based on those arguments, with a period length of 22 hours in Neurospora, the most important events would be happening at night. Or perhaps it's conidiation, but that's So to close this, I agree with what you're saying completely. This, unlike the case with light resetting, is when we showed that freak was acutely induced by light, plotted it against the phase response curve, that was one of these eureka moments when that explained light resetting. I don't think there will be an explanation like that for temperature compensation. The hard part about temperature compensation has been where to start, even, because you've got mutants like Per Long, where they affect period length and compensation for a trivial reason, because you're changing two things at the same time when you change temperature. And so it's just been very hard to know where to start. And so I think the value of this is that it points at phosphorylation as an important process, and it points to CK2 as a pertinent kinase. So it's not any phosphorylation, or it's not any kinase, and it's probably not just any phosphorylation.
But a mathematical thing that we suggested would be that you experimentally, what you should try to do is identify those processes. I mean, I know this is kind of almost impossible, but nevertheless,
nothing. Not in our us, but nothing.
You identify those processes which have significant control coefficients, and those processes which also have very significant, the sort of parameters that correspond to that process have significant dependence on temperature. Because they should then predict which of these processes will affect period and which of the processes will affect temperature.
So you did some of that, Peter, showing that turnover frequency really looks and smells like it.
But, you know, that was a simple model, that was a simple Goodwin model, I think what, and I'm repeating probably myself now from my talk, what we now need to look at are these motifs which can give you additional temperature contributions to the temperature compensation. So degradation clearly is one of those elements. I think also binding to the promoter, the promoter may be one thing. But I think that's what you say, David. We need to see, develop two models and see how does these models give us some clue about the temperature compensation in relation to the experiment.
So, I would disagree just slightly, because it seems to me that most of these processes, a lot of these processes, can have significant control coefficients and significant. It seems to me that the way to get at this is just what WJ is doing, and that is to look for mutants that affect the period without affecting temperature compensation, or that affect temperature compensation without the period. Collect a big group of these mutants in one particular organism, and then try to come up with a model that's consistent with all the mutants. It's not the wild type you want to look at, it's the mutants where the thing breaks in one way or another. And you won't know, I don't think, you'll have the right mechanism here until you have a model.
But I think that's saying the same thing.
Okay, it may be
the other way around.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm going to cut off discussion, because every time temperature compensation comes up, and I would just, it's the same as Albert and me always argue about the cell cycle. But, you know, if you want to continue this, decide to get together this afternoon.
Okay, and this part will be quicker, I think. Once again, the cellular circadian system, freak white collar, driving output with a variety of inputs and some oscillator feeding back to an input on DNA damage. The freakless oscillator is driving output, the nitrate reductase oscillator regulated by temperature, the white collar flow that Deb has worked on, which drives CCG16, and then there's a light modulated oscillator, a cell oscillator that Stu Brody has identified, choline deficiency oscillator that Pat Lake and Thomas works on, the farnesyl geraniol oscillator that Stu has worked on, the CNO that he has identified, ALT that Stu has worked on, and those are just the ones where one can actually, Jeff would say, you can look it up. They're published. So looking at those, all of those either have or with manipulation can be made to have paired lengths within the circadian range. All are distinguishable based on period, medium conditions, or other conditions. So they're not the same thing. You can tell them apart. Only the nitrate reductase oscillator and the white collar flow are known to be connected to the Crete white collar circadian loop. And only the NRO and white collar flow can be followed by any means other than race tubes. One could put in parenthetically here that all of them have been, roles for all of them have been suggested in the circadian system.
And these are seen by forces or?
Mostly by banding, by the conidial banding.
No, I mean, you say that NRO and WC flow can be followed by some other means.
Oh, yes, by both cases by Northerns. Although now we can follow by reporters, but as described in the literature by Northerns and Westerns. Okay, so normally I put this slide in at the beginning. So this is the race tube assay. You can see that nicely in a movie. This is a movie made by Van Gooch some years ago, time lapse of Neurospora developing. So you see it growing down here. And mycelia laid down here are determined to differentiate, and they will do so. Mycelia laid down in that region are determined not to differentiate, and they never will. So that's the assay that has driven all of this genetics. This is luciferase, driven by the CCG2 promoter in Neurospora, growing down a race tube. So this will be the subject of the last vignette here. And this has been very rewarding for me. This was the principal aim of a grant written in 1985. On the maximum, everyone goes back to their graduate work as soon as they get a faculty position. Of course, I did my graduate work on bioluminescence and goniolax, so I thought it'd be trivial to put bioluminescence into Neurospora and do this, and it just never worked. We could never figure out why.
What did you see, actually?
That was a race tube with the CCG2 promoter driving luciferase. Okay. Succeeding generations of postdocs picked this problem up. The only one that made a lick of progress on it was Deb, later in her own lab, who resynthesized the first 21 codons of the enzyme to match a Neurospora codon bias. And that for the first time, so all these years, decades, we'd get great RNA expression, but no protein expression. And of course, the beauty of bioluminescence is you've got 7 log orders over which to look. And so I could just never figure out what was going on. So Deb resynthesized the first 21 codons, and we saw some light. So we were set to spend $100,000 on a camera, and I said, before we do this, this is when Van Gooch was doing a sabbatical in lab. I want to see the whole protein redone, which would not cost $100,000. So they ordered 86 oligonucleotides, 40 bases each with 20 base overlaps, and changed 3/4 of the codons in the organism to match the Neurospora consensus. And doing that, this was the original strain in which one could see light in heterokaryon. And you can see that same promoter here, we've jumped 4 log orders in light production. and that's in a heterocarion. In a homocarion, you can even see more light. So this has now opened up a whole biology to us. We can see bioluminescence in colonies. This is now looking at a race tube from the side. This is the auger surface of the race tube. And what you'll see here is that not only do you get growth above the auger surface, but also Neurospora has, it's like the submarine motoring forward, and actually the submarine growth is going ahead of the surface growth. So this is not circadian biology, but it's interesting biology. Okay, so luminescence from a frequency. So you could see light with a CCG2 promoter. You couldn't see light with a frequency promoter. But of course, from circadian context, there are a lot of things you'd like to do with a bona fide clock gene promoter, which we can now see. This is from colonies. This is from a race tube. This is spore formation from the same race tube. You can see that they're appropriately out of phase. This is free protein levels from liquid culture, and they're appropriately phased with respect to the RNA rhythms here. You get different period lengths with wild type and a long period mutant. And that's a race tube then. I hope all you can see that. This is freak driven luciferase going down a race tube. So you can see that every day you get rhythmic luminescence, but the luminescence continues to cycle in the bands and in the interbands behind the growth front.
If you look at the moving frame, so that you're sort of moving with the tip, is it that the luciferase time series the same as if you sit at the first?
No, these are slightly phase lagged back here. That was known from work by Subbuti Dharmananda from 1979, where they took a petri dish, inoculated at one end, and so that you would have successive bands going out, and then at the end of the experiment, took cores. Back across the petri dish, transfer those cores onto new race tubes so that you could assay phase. All right, if you can follow this. So the observation was there's a phase gradient from the growth front back, as if the clocks in the back are running a little bit more slowly. And we see the same thing here. All right, so one of the things we thought we could do with this would be to start to sort out the hierarchical relationships among some of these ancillary oscillators. So the first one we picked as a case in point was this choline starvation rhythm. So here is the recipient strain, the choline 1 Cas1 strain, and it's known from a lot of work by Pat Lake and Thomas and Stu Brody that the strains of this genetic background, when starved for choline, as they are here, this is a race tube with no choline added, express this very long period conidiation rhythm. So here it's about 80 hours, N of 10. Here it's 72 hours. So this sort of variability is quite typical, but depending on the degree of choline starvation, the period lengths and the temperature, the period lengths can get quite long. So into this strain, we put this construct, a minimal freak promoter driving luciferase. From this whole race tube then, you can measure rhythmic bioluminescence. So this is the raw data, and this is detrended data. You can barely see the periodogram, huh? So this is a periodogram done on the detrended data with a window of 14 to 100 hours. So you see the circadian period length and its multiples up within 100. There's nothing I can do about this except point it out that the 72 hours is right here, and there's no glitch in the periodogram. So there's no evidence for a connection between the 72-hour rhythm and the luminescence rhythm based on that experiment. So here we're going to follow luminescence at each of these different points while the race tube runs down. So race tube grows to this point, which is about 290 hours. Then we give a 3-hour light pulse, which synchronizes all the clocks. And then at the end of the light pulse, it's misplaced. Light pulse should be over here. At the end of the light pulse, then you start monitoring bioluminescence. So as the growth front proceeds down here, initially you're following these bands. As the growth front proceeds down, you pick up these additional bands. Right, so we're going to be following light as a function of time. All right, so growth front is going to move down here. The flash of light here is correctly placed, and then we'll pick up the additional bands. Okay. So they're all rhythmic, and they're more or less in phase with a slight gradient to older. So they start off low and they come up because the growth rate in these strains is very slow. So this is 10 days from here out to here. So over the course of a day, you'll start to pick up light, and then gradually the growth front will move forward, and you'll be picking up more and more light until the region is completely covered. All right, so that's why they're coming up slowly like this. But they're clearly all rhythmic and all maintaining the rhythm, and the rhythm is not 72 hours, but in the circadian range. All right, so another way to do this experiment, again, is to actually follow both in real time. So we're going to follow here the development of the conidial banding rhythm as well as the rhythm in bioluminescence as growth proceeds through this box. Okay, so time here. So here's the luminescence rhythm driven by the freak promoter in a freak seventh strain. And here's the long period conidiation rhythm. So over the course of the experiment, they're running through all the two rhythms are crossing all possible phases between each other. We chose freak 7 here because in the periodogram, the multiples of 29 hours put 72 hours right at the trough. So if we're doing periodogram analysis, and here you can see it a little bit better. So this is a freak 7 recipient into which has been put freak 7 choline 1 recipient into which has been put the reporter. So here's the periodogram analysis of the luciferase from this data. This is not detrended, this is the raw data. With the three multiples and the 70 hours right down here, that's the 1% significance. So there's really no evidence for a contribution of the conidiation rhythm to the circadian rhythm and luminescence. And from prior work from Pat Legg and Thomas's lab, the choline deficiency oscillator is known not to be temperature compensated. And we repeated that data here. These are the race tubes. Here's the densitometry, and this is reproduced from a 1998 publication. So you need to look at the time scale here. This is 0 to 140 hours. So at 20 degrees, they're cycling with about 120 to 130 hours. At 25 degrees, 70 to 80 hours. So that's strongly not compensated. From the same strains, the luciferase rhythm here, done both in wild type and in freak 7 at multiple temperatures, clearly showing compensation. So here again, 0 to 33 hours. So this is the very slight undercompensation of the wild type strain. And in the freak 7, known to be a little bit more undercompensated. But again, nothing like this. So in the same strain at the same time, the choline deficiency oscillator not being temperature compensated, the freak white collar oscillator showing its typical temperature compensation. So this really looks like the conidiation can be controlled by these two different oscillators. Under some conditions, under conditions of choline sufficiency, it's controlled by the circadian oscillator. Under conditions of choline starvation, it's controlled by a choline deficiency oscillator, and the two don't talk to one another. We don't know anything about the biology of this oscillator, why it's important for Neurospora to have this long period length. All of the evidence suggests that this is not contributing to the circadian system. So doing experiments like this, we're hoping that we can start to bring some sense of hierarchical order among the different oscillators. Okay, so we've seen this now several times. So all these different oscillators and some that are not published, and from this constellation we can tentatively take this one out of the picture. Much to your relief, that's it. Shown data from postdoc Bill Belden, who will be looking for a job next year. Also Arun Mehra. Both have done really terrific work. Graduate student Mi Shi, who will also be graduating this year. Chris Hong keeps us honest when we talk about anything having to do with modeling. Luis Lirondo has done a lot of work with me and with Arun on bioluminescence. And of course, everything's done in collaboration with my long-term colleague, Jennifer Loros. And a wonderful textbook. All royalties donated to charity, so you can buy it in a clear conscience. So if there are any additional questions, I'd be happy to take them.